Welcome to Amped Up. This is your host, Ryan Knight, and our guest today is Torin Walker. Torin is a journalist, a documentary filmmaker, and the founder of Context Media Group. Torin, welcome to Amped Up.
Thank you for having me, Ryan.
Look, I kind of want to start off here with, you know, Donald Trump and the White House have finally relented and accepted reality and said the official transition process can begin. And Joe Biden isn't wasting any time. He's made a handful of cabinet picks already. And after 4 years of neo-fascist hell, the nation gets to look forward to 4 years of neoliberal hell as Biden is filling his team with warmongers, corporate lobbyists, big oil puppets, and DNC loyalists. 2 days ago, Biden chose Tony Blinken as Secretary of State, who was key to shoring up Democrat support for the Iraq invasion, and instrumental in the U.S.'s role in the regime change wars in Ukraine, Libya, and Syria, which means the endless wars will continue. And just to add insult to injury, liberals on Twitter are celebrating Biden's cabinet that's full of corporatists, war hawks, lobbyists, and big oil puppets. They are actually celebrating the nothing will fundamentally change cabinet, proving that most liberals don't care about war, corruption, and corporate greed when a Democrat is doing it. You know, Joe Biden keeps saying that he wants to be the president for all Americans. But his corporatist cabinet appointments and neoliberal politics suggest he wants to be president for Wall Street, giant corporations, and Americans who are comfortable with the status quo. This moment in history calls for a new economic bill of rights that lifts up the poor, the working class, and communities of color. This moment calls for revolutionary change, and Biden is trying to govern like it's still 2008. Torin, what is your reaction to Biden's cabinet picks?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about this election being a victory, and it has been a victory. It's been a victory for optics. What's happening is what you're seeing. A lot of people who were forced to deal with what America truly looks like under Trump have the luxury to go back to sleep now. And I'll use an example. This morning, I had a conversation with somebody who was, she considers herself a liberal. She considers herself anti-Trump. She's a strong opponent of Trump. And we were talking about how things are not going to fundamentally change outside of the optics of what are happening as far as like the cabinet picks. And she told me point blank that she was glad that Trump is gone because now she can go back to her normal life. That is pretty much in a nutshell what liberal America and centrist America wants to happen. Trump was too much of an irritant to not be aware of what was going on. And the fact that he's gone and Biden is going to come in is really just basically giving people a chance to go back to sleep. And for some people, that's comforting. For people who are at the margins of the society, that's extremely dangerous.
Right. And, you know, the progressive movement did not spend the past 4 years marching, protesting, and organizing for this nation to go back to business as usual. We did that to move this nation forward and build a better world. Yet based on Biden's, you know, corporate cabinet picks, he's not hearing us at all. And sadly, many of us predicted this would happen. This is exactly why we were pushing so hard for concessions from Biden during the general, because we knew it was the only time we could move him left, as we actually had leverage over him because he needed our votes. And liberals, kind of the ones you're talking about, they shamed us, they harassed us, they called us Trump supporters because we had the audacity to demand better from Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. They even tried to cancel the rapper Ice Cube because he was demanding a new economic contract for Black America. You were also someone who was challenging Biden and the Democrats to be better, especially considering the moment we are living in, where there is massive levels of injustice and inequality. And these same liberals who were harassing us during the general for demanding better are now celebrating Biden's status quo cabinet. Torin, are these liberals standing in the way of progress? Because it feels like they don't care about actually demanding better from the Democratic Party and demanding policies that will lift up the poor, the working class, and communities of color. They only seem to care about symbolic victories, not victories that actually help the people.
Well, I think one thing to be clear on is the fact that the people who we call liberals now would have been called conservatives 50, 60 years ago. So as far as them standing in the way of progress, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what they do. But even if you go back further to the 50s and 60s, leaders like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King talked about the problem of the white liberal and the white moderate, who's more concerned about, you know, the status quo and about safety and peace than about real progress. And this is what you're dealing with. The problem with that now is these people are really more concerned about the optics. And I keep going back to optics because that's what most people's level of understanding of politics in this situation is really on. It's about what looks good, what feels good to me. What's not so much about what's going to really change anything for marginalized people. It's about what can I do that makes me feel good, that doesn't really have to make me sacrifice too much. And what you're seeing right now is that mentality brought all the way up to the DNC, all the way through the rank and file of the Democratic Party, to the point where people who are pushing for progress are seen as the enemy, and people who are hardcore Trump supporters are people that need to be reached out to. That's a fundamental disconnect with the leadership of the Democratic Party and the rank and file. And until that changes, you're going to continue to see this.
Well, right. And I mean, it's frustrating because, you know, this past summer, it doesn't match the energy that we're seeing on the ground. You know, this past summer, we saw the largest protest in our nation's history for Black lives. And these protests helped propel Biden and Harris to the White House, as we saw a spike in voter registration in big cities like Detroit and Atlanta, which were determinative in deciding the Electoral College. Yet Biden has called for more police funding, not less. And corporate Democrats in Congress actually tried to blame the slogan defund the police, and they tried to blame Medicare for All for why they lost seats in the House. And if you actually dig into the details, it's a total lie. The progressives who ran on Medicare for All and ran on, you know, true criminal justice reform all won re-election, while it was kind of the uninspiring corporatists who ran status quo campaigns who lost. Torin, is it time for the Democratic Party to stop taking Black voters for granted and start delivering results to a constituency which time and time again has been the most loyal base of the party?
It's way past time for the Democrats to stop taking Black voters for granted. And as far as what you were saying about like what the difference between the grassroots and the people in power, there has always been a disconnect between what people demand and want in poor and working class communities and the leadership, even of some of those organizations, of what they want and the people who they're trying to get close to. As far as Black voters, I think what you're seeing is this: for anything to really change, you're going to have to remove some of the people who have been considered the gatekeepers of the Black vote. These people are really more concerned with being close to the positions of power than they are with dealing with their constituents. And until, again, and it's a horrible thing to have to deal with, but it's the truth. I think some of these people do have a history of fighting for Black rights, for fighting for Black lives, and advocating for Black people. But I think something happens when you get into the halls of power and you get close to that, you become more and more like the people you're trying to fight against and the people you're supposed to represent. And we're seeing people who have been in Congress for 30, 40 years, sometimes bordering on 50 years, who are basically the only people that the quote unquote white power structure or the establishment power structure in Washington listens to. And they're more concerned with trying to keep their positions, and they're more concerned with trying to keep their seats than trying to really deal with what their constituents want. That has to fundamentally change. And also, you have to give space for people who are on the ground and actually doing this work to be able to speak to power without having to go through a gatekeeper. Because if you go to the protests and you go to people who are leading the protests on the ground and taking the risks, they really know how to articulate their demands. They don't really need interpreters. They need to be heard. And the people who are in the way need to move aside, or at the very least, bring these people in so they can be listened to.
No, that's right. And it you know, we're at a point where it seems like, you know, the Democratic Party has kind of mastered the art of, you know, co-opting the language of the progressive movement and co-opting the language of, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement without actually supporting the policies, you know, that activists are calling for. You know, corporate Democrats will say things like Black Lives Matter, but they won't actually support, you know, defunding the police and shifting resources into Black and brown communities. You know, or they'll say, you know, that healthcare is a human right, but they won't fight for the policy, Medicare for All, to make healthcare a human right. You know, their favorite one is they'll say climate change is real, you know, but they won't actually fight for a Green New Deal to take the bold action that we need. So, you know, they use kind of these platitudes and this lip service because they want votes, but they don't actually want to earn our votes, and they don't want to, you know, earn the people who are at the margins. They don't want to actually give people policies that will improve their lives. They just, it's like, okay, you know, give us power and then maybe we'll do something for you down the road. But look, we're seeing right now, Joe Biden is not listening to the people who put him in power. he's listening to corporate America right now. And every single one of these cabinet picks, like it astounds me just to see the disconnect on Twitter right now and to hear these liberals gloating over this cabinet. This cabinet is not a cabinet that is for the working class and that is for marginalized communities. This is a cabinet that will continue business as usual in Washington. And business as usual in Washington means that everyday Americans are going to continue to struggle because the system has been rigged, and it's been rigged a long time, you know, for the billionaire class, for Wall Street, and against, you know, everyday people, and especially people of color. There was a statistic that just blew my mind recently where the black-white wealth gap in America is as high today and wide today as it was back in 1968.
Yes.
During the Civil Rights Movement. That is unacceptable. And for the Democratic Party to say that it's black people are the backbone of the party, well, then deliver results, then show the black community that they are the backbone of the party by fighting for policies that will improve their lives. It's so frustrating for me as a progressive activist to see this happening still. It's like we just had a neo-fascist in the White House and that didn't wake you up. Do you not understand that if you govern business as usual, that's just going to lead people to be desperate enough again in 2024 to vote for another neo-fascist, because the corporatists once again got power, the corporate Democrats, and they didn't do anything with their power to help everyday people. So this vicious cycle continues.
Exactly. And the reason it continues goes back to what I was saying, this obsession with optics, because like you said, all the people who Biden is appointing, it's a very diverse cabinet on the surface. You know, you have people of color, you have women of color, you have black people, you have LGBT people, but optics doesn't really matter and your identity doesn't really matter if you're creating the same status quo that got people out on the streets in the first place. I think there's so much of an emphasis on the optics of something instead of looking at the policy that somebody is promoting. We're getting is what you're saying. You know, we're seeing this loop of, you know, get a fascist out, bring in a diverse cabinet, create the same policies that weren't quite as loud as what the fascist was doing, but it's the same policies on a quiet level done with the right table manners. So everybody keeps quiet. I'm going to go back to my point about the people who these people are talking to and the people who are making these decisions are not people who are in the grassroots or in the status quo. These are people who they go to lunch with and they go to dinner with all the time. And these people have basically separated themselves from the majority of people of color and also the poor and the working class. Their class is the power class. These people go to, like I said, these people all hang out together. These people may have come through the same law firms. They may have been on the same business deals together. So what you're getting is people who are making deals with each other that have absolutely nothing to do with the people on the ground. And all you're doing is, as you said, you're creating a condition to where people put all this hope into voting and all this effort into voting without doing any of the grassroots work about, like, okay, now that we voted, what do we get for our vote? And what you're going to see is the same thing happen again in 2022 and 2024. And I also want to go back to your other point that you said earlier about what happened with Ice Cube. It was the most fascinating thing to me to watch people of color and black people condemning somebody for demanding tangibles for their vote before that vote was cast. I'd never seen that before. It was really fascinating to watch. I don't know who created this idea that giving somebody optics and creating dance battles in the street was going to be enough to get people into the voting booth and that's going to be satisfactory. I think the people who were creating that idea were people who were possibly looking for some sort of benefit for that for themselves in a Biden cabinet, maybe some sort of post or maybe some sort of position where they would be the person to be listened to when it comes to black issues and brown issues. But I thought it was horrible what happened with that. And another thing I want to talk about is some of the pandering that went on in black communities, especially. When Kamala Harris and when Joe Biden went to talk to every other ethnic group or every other economic group, they went to meeting halls in suits. You didn't see them dancing. You didn't see them pop blocking. You didn't see them using old rap lyrics or using rappers from 1995 to try to get a message out to black people. It's serious. I was sitting back this and I was like, how can you say that you're relying on the backbone of your party when you don't even respect their intelligence enough to come to them with policy and come to them with positions, and you think giving them dance battles and giving them freestyle battles is going to satisfy them? It's, you know, until that mentality changes, you're going to keep seeing this sort of ridiculous performative wokeness and performative display that doesn't really benefit the material conditions of black people on the ground and black people who are poor and working class. And that has to fundamentally change. And the people who are advising these people are either complete opportunists or they have absolutely no clue of what the conditions are of people on the ground. And that's going to have to change.
Yeah. And I think it's been going on for so long that we know, like, there's a complicit element to it. Like, let's not get it twisted. The DNC knows what it's doing. You know, they know that they want to continue taking money from Wall Street and their corporate donors. And that's why they continue to put Wall Street and their corporate donors over the basic needs of the people. I mean, liberals have a hard time accepting it, but it's just the flat out truth. You can go check the receipts. This year in 2020, Wall Street gave more money to the Democratic Party than it gave to the Republican Party. And you're telling me that, like, that's not a problem? Like, and when I tell liberals that stat, they always dismiss it. And it's almost like, oh no, you know, big money only corrupts Republicans. It's like, can you hear yourself? You're telling me that you're not concerned at the fact that, you know, Wall Street gave millions and millions and millions of dollars to not only Joe Biden's campaign, but also to a lot of these corporate Democrats. Like, that doesn't concern you. And then you watch them govern and they go on CNN and yeah, they say, again, they say the right things. These mm-hmm. corporate Democrats have mastered the art of kind of, you know, sedating the country with these platitudes of hope and change.
Exactly.
But then turning around and governing, you know, for Wall Street and their corporate donors, just like the Republicans do. And we're at a moment in history where, you know, platitudes isn't enough. You know, platitudes aren't going to stop the climate crisis. These platitudes they spout on TV is not going to stop the racial injustice crisis or the, you know, the economic inequality crisis. You know, we've got massive problems and we have solutions for them. We know that Medicare for All will help the 92 million Americans who are either underinsured or uninsured. You know, we know that a Green New Deal will help shift, you know, our economy from relying on fossil fuels to moving it to clean energy, and it will create millions of jobs in the process. You know, we know that, you know, things like universal basic income and, you know, even looking at stuff like reparations for the Black community, we know these things will lift up the material conditions of the people who are struggling. But the Democrats don't want to look at any of it. They just want to, again, spout these platitudes and then govern for their corporate donors. And that those are the exact conditions which led to Trump in the first place. So someone like me, I'm nervous that we're just, you know, delaying the inevitable and we're going to be stuck with an even worse and more competent fascist, because as bad as Trump was, he's pretty incompetent. You know, he was so narcissistic that he cared more about what the media said about him than about actually being, you know, if he really wanted to do more damage, he could have, you know, but it was all about himself. And my big fear is we're going to have an even worse Trump if Biden governs the way I expect him to govern, which is for Wall Street and not for Main Street.
Well, here's the thing. Even if you go downtown and try to borrow money from a loan shark, nobody loans you money without expecting something in return in interest. So that's it's right. A ridiculous statement to say that, you know, taking money from Wall Street doesn't have any strings attached to it and their agendas are not going to be pushed. As far as platitudes, I think we need to be clear, though. The reason platitudes are given to people so often is because a lot of times they work. And the reason that is because so many people who are trying to put food on the table and so many people who have never been heard before, I'm talking about like marginalized communities, I'm talking about, you know, Black and brown communities, I'm talking about people who may have physical disabilities or maybe veterans, they have been ignored for years. So if you come to them with just a little bit of pandering and say that, listen, I hear you, I see your pain, and I want to do what I can for you, that will get you a phenomenal amount of loyalty for people until they wake up and realize that the platitudes aren't going to put food on their table and it's not going to change their conditions any. That's what we're dealing with right now. And I think you're right. The DNC and establishment Democrats have mastered the game of like giving people a little bit of lip service about what their issues are, but never really doing anything concrete to give them anything to try to alleviate those conditions. I think people on the ground are aware of this. And I think people who are poor and working class really are aware of this, but they're afraid of jeopardizing any kind of security that they may have to ask for a little bit more. And that's not a failing of them, it's a failing of their leadership. So I think if you get people who are from the working class who are poor, people who may have been homeless, people who have been in prison, who have been out, who are just as articulate and are closer to the real material conditions of people who are living those lives and give those people platforms and let them speak instead of having them try to go to a power structure that doesn't really care about them anyway outside of optics, I think you may see some change in that. But as long as you have people who are corporate Democrats, as long as you have people who are career politicians who are going to be in power no matter which way, what happens to the country, no matter who is the president and who is not, this is going to continue. And I think we're headed towards a catastrophe with that, because I think people's patience is wearing thin. And I think people are getting just desperate enough to do something catastrophic.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the path we are on right now is unsustainable. And I don't get how, I mean, I guess there are enough comfortable liberals who just think, like, I had friends after, you know, Trump lost. And look, I did not want Trump to win re-election. Mm-hmm. But what I want more than anything is for fundamental change in this country, so that every human being in the quote unquote richest nation on earth, supposedly, gets to live a life of dignity, you know, and justice. And until that happens, I don't care who they put in charge of this system, because the entire system is corrupt. So you got rid of the corrupt president. Now, guess what? The corrupt system is still alive and well. And from every person Joe Biden has picked, it looks like he's just going to go in there and continue this, you know, this system, which has robbed people of so much. And my mind can't wrap my head around the fact that during this pandemic, we had the billionaire class make over $1 trillion while working people are barely keeping their head above water, if that. You know, I do. It's like we're in a second Gilded Age. And Democrats are supposed to be the party that cares about the poor and the working class and communities of color. But they've become the party that just panders with platitudes and then gives Wall Street everything it wants. And then anyone who tries to push back on that, people like me, you know, prominent activists who will speak loudly and clearly about the failures of the Democratic Party to actually help the people who are most in need, we become enemies and we become, you know, they have thrown everything they've tried at just me. I'm just a little grassroots activist. And they've done it to so many, you know, my friend Brianna, who was the national press secretary for Bernie Sanders. I mean, she's like public enemy number one for the more liberals. And she's a woman of color who again is fighting for bold policies that will lift up everyone. You know, yes, they will lift up communities of color, but they will also lift up, you know, poor and working class voters who've been taken for granted of by both parties. And let's not act like the Republican Party is a saint. I mean, they're basically, you know, just like the Democratic Party, except even a little bit worse and more racist. You know, they use race baiting and they try to scapegoat immigrants. And because, again, they're working for their donors, they just have a different message to keep their base and their, you know, lockstep following, you know, their party. It's almost like we've got two parties who just kind of sedate their base with the right platitudes and the right things to kind of keep their base obedient and compliant and from demanding better. You know, it's like so many Americans, I see the system continues because people just accept it for what it is. And when working class people, you know, I said this to someone the other day, they're like, why do you fight the system so much? I'm like, because it doesn't matter how hard a working class person works if they're working in a system that has been rigged against them. You know what I mean? Like working class people, nobody works harder than working class people. And yet they still can't get ahead because the laws in Washington have been rigged to favor Wall Street and the rich. And they've been rigged against the people who are working so hard and have been carrying this nation on its back for the last half century.
Well, you know, that's the American way, you know, to advance this country on the backs of the poor and the working class and the enslaved throughout history. It's interesting that you brought up Bree, because I've seen what's been happening to her. And it's kind of interesting that these same people who were saying vote like Black women and listen to Black women for the past 4 years were the first people to shut down Black women when they went against the status quo. I saw what happened with Nina Turner, how she was brutally attacked and how she was insulted in ways that nobody should tolerate. So, and I saw what happened to Bree. You know, we mentioned Ice Cube earlier. I saw what happened with Killer Mike when he tried to do the same thing. And it's like there's a sense of ownership from establishment Democrats about like the vote of the working class and the vote of the poor, and especially the vote of the Black voter. It feels like if you are willing to be patronized and you're willing to be pandered to, then everything is fine. But the minute you start demanding something and you start saying that something's happening in your community that's unsatisfactory, the first people to shut you down and use even language that even some of the alt-right won't use are your so-called friends in the Democratic Party. And it's amazing to watch. It's really fascinating to see a party that's built with the reputation of supposed to being for the poor and the working class attack its base this way. I've never seen that be a winning strategy in any political process. I've never seen any political party be able to do that outside of the Republicans. But the difference with the Republicans and the GOP, regardless, even though their policies are heinous and even though they're extremely detrimental to the American public, one thing that they do have, which is a strength for them, is that they do not deviate from what they say they believe in. The problem with the Democratic Party is that, depending on what day it is, you can get a different policy platform from the establishment Democrats. You know, if things are moving this way, we'll go this way. If a poll we get the next day says that that's not going to work, okay, then we'll go over here. I think the people who are the progressives in the party really stand on their principles, but the people who are in control, the DNC, Perez, and people like that, they are so concerned with polling and they're so concerned with numbers and they're so concerned with being everybody's friend that they're nobody's friend. And this is a holdover from, I hate to say this, but it's the truth. I think it's a holdover from the first term of Obama, because Obama's first term, Obama came into the White House with a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate. He could have passed any legislation he wanted to, but I think him and his cabinet were so busy trying to mend fences and make friends with people who were going to block every single thing he did from the time he went into the White House to the time he left, that I think that became the general party line of the party. And I don't think they've recovered from that. There comes a time when you have to get down and fight. You know what I mean? You may not look for a fight, but if somebody hits you in the mouth, you're in a fight. And I think the Democrat and the establishment Democrats don't realize that that's where they are. And they're going to lose. And they're going to lose big. That's why the elections that's brought Biden to the White House weren't a sweep for everybody. And I think until they realize that, you're going to see them continually lose elections. They're going to lose local elections. They're going to lose the Senate. They're going to lose the House. And eventually, you're going to get one term out of this.
Well, yeah. And you know, there's this mindset with, you're hitting the nail on the head, the Democratic Party, especially the establishment Democrats, who think that, like, in order to win, that we have that they should compromise their values. You know, that they should compromise their progressive values. No, if you want to win, actually win, and win for the people, and win for your base who's working so hard on the ground for you, you don't compromise your values. You have to fight for your values. And and so the last 50 years, you've seen Republicans just unapologetically fight for their, you know, far right kind of neo-fascist, almost white, you know, it's not almost, it is a white nationalist agenda, you know, hard line on immigration. They just fight for it unapologetically, and that energizes their base. And then you got the Democrats' response to that kind of neo-fascism is, well, you know, we're going to keep working for Wall Street and keep taking all the, you know, the corporate money. And we're just going to kind of, like, you know, condemn we'll condemn what the Republicans are doing, but we're not going to actually fight for anything substantial, right? We're not going to have a counter message that, you know, we're going to let the Republicans use the scare word of socialism, right, to prevent us from actually fighting for policies that help the poor and the working class and communities of color. And we're just going to allow the Republicans to drag our entire country to the right. That's really what's happened for the last 50 years. And until the Democrats or another party rises that is not bought and paid for by Wall Street and that actually wants to govern for the people and actually gives the American people a compelling message on why we need true progressive change that lifts everyone up, the country is going to continue to be in this kind of vicious cycle that goes back and forth every 4 to 8 years, from kind of this neo-fascism on the right to this kind of neoliberalism in the center that doesn't really help anyone but the rich and the wealthy. And so that's kind of where we're at right now. And it is so frustrating because, you know, we could have won this election, beated Donald Trump, and moved America forward. But instead, we got Trump out of the White House, and it doesn't feel like we're moving forward at all. It feels like we're going back to 2016, back to business as usual, you know, back to the very conditions that led, you know, people to be desperate enough to vote for a con man like Trump. And it just feels like we're going to be stuck in this cycle until we can kind of break this corporate duopoly and this stranglehold that big money has over both parties in Washington.
Yeah, I'll even go a little bit further. I think it's not even just going back to 2016. I think we're going back to 1964. And I want to give a little bit of background on that. I think most people know that up until 1964, the Democratic Party as we know it and the Republican Party as we know it, it pretty much were switched. the Republicans used to be where the progressives, and that's where the liberals, and that's where the people who were about civil rights and about healthcare and Social Security for and creating a net for the working people, they were in that party. The Democrats were basically run by the Dixiecrats like Strom Thurmond and Robert Byrd and people like that. When Lyndon Johnson signed the 1964 Civil Rights Act after being pushed by Martin Luther King, there was a mass exodus of people from the Democratic Party, the right wing, white nationalists, and the Dixiecrats over to the Republican Party. And the liberals moved over into the Democrats. The problem with that is the leadership of the Democratic Party since 1980 and that beating by Reagan, they've been missing those voters ever since. And they've been fighting every tooth and nail to try to get those people back. And instead of dealing with the people and the younger people who moved into the party, or would have been an excellent base to try to grow and cultivate a progressive party, a progressive left party, that could have been a strong challenger to right wing nationalism, and it started coming back in under Reagan. They just have their whole thing has basically been, well, let's be moderate, let's move the center over to the right, to the point now what you have now is basically a center right party masquerading as a Democratic Party.
That's right.
And yeah, you know, I mean, you saw that even back when there was a battle between Tom Perez and Keith Ellison for the leadership of the DNC, and Keith Ellison lost. And Keith Ellison was one of the main people in the Democratic leadership who said publicly, pay attention to Donald Trump. Donald Trump could very much win this thing. I remember when he was on George Stephanopoulos and they basically laughed him off air. And yep. We see the result of this. And you got in Perez, who's really more of an apparatchik than really a leader, and he's not really galvanizing. And what you've seen since then is basically this whole sort of milquetoast idea that maybe if we meet them halfway, maybe if we censor them, as you said, and maybe if we condemn their more strong language, but still be willing to work with them, maybe something will come along. And you can't negotiate with a rattlesnake. This is what you're dealing with. I just think they don't understand that what they're dealing with are hardcore white nationalists and people who are so reactionary that they're willing to take this country back to the 1950s, even after this election and even after this win. And I think all the celebrating is extremely premature, and it's also unwarranted. All you're seeing right now is an election that's going to lull people back to sleep and make them feel like the monster in the attic is gone. We can celebrate. Well, these people are very, very organized. These people are very, very determined, and they're determined. And right now they feel as though something's been taken from them. And there's nothing more dangerous than a white nationalist who feels like something's been denied from him. This is very dangerous. People need to be more vigilant now than they were the last 4 years. And we really need a party. And even if we have to create a third party or more than one party that's willing to acknowledge that and work for the people and realize that there's a direct existential threat to this country, nothing's going to really change except for the worse.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, and look, I disagree with everything that Trump and the GOP stand for, but they fight for their agenda. You know, they fight, they know what they're fighting for, and they fight for it. And then you got these Democrats who are kind of, you know, have this, they don't really stand for anything. You know, Joe Biden's not really fighting for anything except his corporate donors. And so when you can't even deliver a compelling vision for the American people, how is that ever going to stop this neo-fascism? You know, and it almost feels to me, it's like, you know, standing half, what is centrism in anymore? What, you're standing halfway between neo-fascism and justice? You know, that's complicity. Like, mm-hmm. why are you trying to meet these neo-fascists halfway? Why don't you come over with the people who are actually fighting for justice and policies that will lift everyone up? You know, they've become enamored with a horrible politics, a politics of scapegoating, you know, this neo-fascist white nationalist politics. But I guarantee mm-hmm. you, as soon as they have Medicare for all, you know, I guarantee you, as soon as they have something like a UBI, or, you know, they start to see that, oh, wow, a Green New Deal, like I've got a job back. That was, you know, a lot of these people in the Midwest, especially, they lost their jobs because corporate America sent them away, you know, 20 mm-hmm. years ago. And mm-hmm. so when they actually see that, like, progressive politics are for you, not for the ruling class, that's how you get these people to wake up. You don't get them to wake up by having these kind of centrists go on TV and just shame them and you know, point their finger at them and call them stupid. You know, I heard someone on TV the other day, like, oh, all these people in red states that Trump won, they're not as educated, they're undereducated and they make less money. And then in my head, I'm thinking like, oh yeah, that's exactly how you reach out to those kind of people. Tell them they're not educated and tell them they don't make any money, instead of actually trying to have policies that benefit all Americans. That's how you mm-hmm. unify the country. Biden always talks about, oh, I want to heal the nation. Medicare for all will heal the nation. A universal Literally. Basic income will heal the nation. A Green New Deal will heal the nation. When people's material conditions rise, they're happier. You know, when everyone has health care, we'll be happier. But again, it just seems like the Democrats don't want to have any of it. They don't want to actually fight for anything that would help anyone besides their corporate donors.
Well, I think that's a twofold issue. The first one is the one you mentioned, how the media talks to people in red states and people who are not in flyover country. I've worked in media for a while, and I can tell you it is one thing that is true that a lot of people who back Trump said, there definitely is a lot of media bias and there is a lot of arrogance in New York and L.A. about people in the middle of America. And you're not going to reach these people with the sort of arrogant, condescending statements about the South and about the Midwest and even about D.C., the way these people talk about these people, if you're not on the ground dealing with people who are actually putting in work, and there is a mass and there is a huge network of people in these states who are progressive, but they're not talked to, they're not given time on cable news, they're not given any kind of platform. You're seeing it right now in Georgia. I'm in Atlanta, and there's been basically a huge influx of people who are trying to move the Senate race down between Ossoff and Warnock. And there are a lot of people who are coming in from LA, DC, New York. They're trained professionals, basically, when it comes to canvassing, but they don't know the culture here. And there's already been some culture clashes here because there's people don't understand how things are done in the South. They don't understand how things are done in the Midwest, in Louisiana. And instead of reaching out to find people who live here and who work here and know the cultural layout of places, they're coming down with these condescending attitudes. And I'm telling you, it's going to backfire on people. I'm not saying that they don't have good intentions, but, you know, there's a saying I heard once, and it's the truth. Culture eats strategy for breakfast. If you don't know the people you're trying to reach, you're just not going to reach them, and anything you're trying to do is not going to work. That's one part of it. The other part of it is, going back to what you said earlier, you know, these people aren't getting any kind of play in the media because there's a definite complicity between corporate media and corporate Democrats. They want to give you the illusion of saying that I'm against Trump. They want to give you the illusion of saying we're against white nationalism. We're against fascism. We're against these heinous things that have happened to people in ICE camps. And we're against the police brutality against black people in America. But let's not forget that while Trump was in office, CNN was giving people who were hardcore white nationalists, alt-right people, TV shows. They were giving them airtime almost every night. They were giving them basically 30 minutes a night for almost 2 to 3 years to spout their hatred on cable news to 20 to 30 million people a night. People who are fighting against fascism don't give it platforms. So what you're seeing is just a continuation of that. Now that that's gone, now they have to pivot over to this idea that now that Trump is gone, it's like the end of World War II and we can all celebrate and fascism is defeated. No, it's not. If you had the same people in practice who are more competent than the people Trump put in, but they're still creating these imperialist status quo policies, but they're doing it as black people and they're doing it as marginalized people, then what movement have you really made? If anything, it's more dangerous because they're quieter.
That's right. And it lulls the country back to sleep. You know, I think the oligarchs love it when the Democrats are in power because they can continue to profit off of these endless wars. They can continue to profit off destroying our planet. They can continue to profit off of exploiting the working class. And liberals just turn the other way because they think, oh, everything's better now because the quote unquote good guys are in charge. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, you know, the rig system and the corrupt system is still doing its thing. You know, predatory capitalism is still doing its thing in America, but liberals act like everything's better now. And I think it is so dangerous. I want to get back to something. You know, you hit the nail on the head at this show, just talking about optics and how corporate Democrats and the political establishment, you know, they love these symbolic gestures instead of pushing for the transformative change that we need to actually heal this nation. And one of those changes, I think, a nation cannot move forward until it makes amends for its past, right? It's almost like, think of it in your own lives, everyone who's listening. Like for me, you know, I couldn't move forward in my own life until I made right everything that I had done wrong in my past. And I had a moment where I'm public about it, but I got sober 9 years ago. And part of that process is I had to make amends to everyone that I had harmed. Well, newsflash America, this nation has harmed a lot of people. And the biggest harm is slavery. And we have not made amends for slavery and more recently, the state-sanctioned murder of black people. And these little symbolic things are not enough, right? So, Torn, does the United States need to have a full Truth and Reconciliation Committee to finally provide reparations to Black people for the atrocities committed against them by the United States government? And if so, what do proper reparations look like?
Well, to answer your first question, yes, there absolutely needs to be a Truth and Reconciliation Committee funded by this government to talk about the horrors that have been perpetrated against Black people in America.
Amen.
And I also think that what needs to happen is there also needs to be, as well as that, that needs to be televised. And I also think it needs to be entered into academic curriculums, because a lot of what we're dealing with in America is we have an amazing capacity for forgetting our history.
That's right.
Even the good parts of our history. History is really not being taught in American classrooms from the high school level, even up until the academic level. If you listen to some of the conversations people have who are even PhDs and how ignorant they are of American history, I think that needs to be a part of any kind of reconciliation. And the first part of that is going to have to be really getting into the ugly, horrific truth of how this country has treated African Americans. I think a lot of the hostility and a lot of the resistance to an idea of reparations is because people really don't know the extent and the destruction and the generational brutality that was done to African Americans by the United States government and by the system. That has to be the first part of it. The second
kind of unpack
part
that
it,
a little bit, just, you know, give, because
okay,
I think there
yeah.
is, I think there is a fundamental lack of understanding about just from how it, you know, there were laws that, you know, Black people couldn't even own a home, and or they were kicked out of certain neighborhoods with things like redlining, you know, and the number one way a family builds wealth is, you know, owning a home and living off their Social Security. And that was taken, just owning a home was taken away from Black people for a very long time.
But yeah, I mean, look, the history of Black people in America has been about ownership and been about for Black people. And it's been about the lack of ownership for African Americans, even down to the point where we couldn't even own our bodies. That started on the Middle Passage. The horrible sexual abuse and psychological abuse that happened on those ships continued from the time African Americans landed here, even up until the present day. And you had people who did not own the they were not able to control the earnings that they made from their own labor. They weren't even able to control their labor. And you've had people who, even when they were so-called, quote unquote, set free after the Civil War, they were marginalized to the point where they can only work in certain professions. They can only live in certain areas. Even if they move west, they can only work in certain professions then. And even if they went away and they tried to create their own communities, like in Tulsa or like in Rosewood in Florida, if they got too prosperous, they were burned to the ground. They were destroyed. To the point where, like, to the point where, even if you take it into an individual standpoint, where, like, if you're an individual Black person and you're in the wrong area at the wrong time, you could lose your life. And I think that sort of fear, that sort of terror, that sort of economic disenfranchisement, that sort of educational disenfranchisement has to be addressed. But I think the first part of addressing that is by educating the public and even some people of color and some Black people that this is the history, this is your history in this country. You've been here since 1555, some say 1619, the math may be off, whatever, but this is the history here. But even with that history, you've done amazing things, you've built amazing things, you are still capable of building amazing things, but you had to be given a framework and you had to be given an opportunity to build on what you've created and create your own enterprise. And I think part of that is giving people, well, I won't say giving because I think we've earned that after 500 years here. I think part of that is letting people, maybe whether it's grants, whether it's a lump sum payments, whether it's educational opportunities. I think all those things are important because it can't just be one thing. My personal feeling is I don't think one lump sum payment will do it. I think that it has to be tied to land grants. I think it has to be tied to education. I think it also, again, has to be tied to employment opportunities. I think it has to be tied to business loans. I think there's a lot of different ways. And I think people like Dr. Darity, Dr. Claude Anderson, and other people have done this work, and they a little bit more well-versed in this than I may be. But to go back to your point, I think, yes, America has to give a reckoning to what it's done to African-Americans, and it has to be done soon because this particular circumstance can't continue.
Well, and look, and I mean, while we're seeing massive levels of wealth inequality in this country, it hits no one harder than the Black community. Like I said earlier, the racial, the Black-white wealth gap is as wide today as it was in 1968. I mean, that is just, I can't, there's no words to put to how horrifying that is. And so, and I think, you know, you're absolutely right. It has to be structural. You know, to combat this kind of systemic racism, we need structural healing. Healing where there's systems in place. So instead of, you know, oppressing Black people, it's actually allowing Black people to build better lives. And so it's, you know, from, like you said, education to pay, to cash payments to, you know, it has to be, and it has to, again, structural. So it's at the root of the problem. So it's not just like, okay, one thing and it's done, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that things like that, I mean, why isn't the Democratic Party talking about that? You know, if Black people are the base of the party, like why are they so scared and afraid of reparations? They should be talking about it like we are today.
They won't talk about it because the Black people they listen to are afraid to talk about it. Something I want to say about that is if there's going to be a commission and if there's actually, if reparations actually becomes a tangible thing, it can't be administered just by a small group of academics or even Black people in Congress. It has to be something from people. It has to be a commission created by people from the grassroots. That's some right. people in Congress and people who are in academia, because look, there are a lot of Black people who are fine with the status quo. And there are a lot of Black people who benefit from the status quo. And they also benefit from their jobs benefit by keeping the status quo. So just because someone is Black, just because someone is a person of color does not mean they're your friend, you know, and that's why you're not having a real hard conversation, at least not publicly, about reparations, because the people who benefit from the way things are, the people who benefit from by Biden packing his cabinet with imperialists and corporatists, are not going to jeopardize their jobs. So until that changes, you're going to continue to see this go around and around. You're going to see H.R. 40 keep going around and around with no real movement until you move those people out, or you get people with voices who can advocate actually for poor and working class Black people, not just the people they go to tea with, talking about that.
I want to shift and talk about what I think is the biggest scandal of the year, and that is that the United States government and both corporate parties back in March passed a massive wealth transfer for the ruling class and basically left its people to die during this pandemic. They even had the audacity to call it the CARES Act. Well, it had a lot of care for the billionaire class and zero care for the poor and the working class and our most vulnerable. And the consequences have been staggering. According to Feeding America, there are now over 50 million people who are going hungry in the so-called richest nation on earth. We have 40 million Americans who are facing eviction, 30 million Americans who are unemployed, and 21% of small businesses have already closed permanently. Now let's check in on the billionaire class and the giant corporations. U.S. billionaires have increased their wealth by over $1 trillion during the pandemic. Amazon's profits are up 100%. Walmart's profits are up 80%. Target's profits are up 80%. Microsoft, Facebook, Google, and Apple all have their stocks are all at a record high. And why this to me is the biggest scandal of the year is because this was a political choice by both parties who chose to bail out their corporate donors and abandon the American people during this pandemic. And they basically gave the people a $1,200 check and told them to go F off. And they still haven't passed another, you know, they still haven't done anything. They still haven't passed a second stimulus. Like, I just don't get it. Torin, what is your reaction to the fact that our government does not care about its people? And how do we get this corrupt government to actually care about its people and do what it's supposed to do, govern for the people?
Well, my reaction is I'm not really surprised at all. You could see this coming even up until the election, where basically Trump was holding the stimulus hostage and you couldn't get a solid answer from the DNC or Biden's camp about what they were going to do about that. So as far as that, I'm not surprised. I think the only way to really hold them accountable is the people who are in Congress who actually come from the working class and who have empathy for the working class, people like, you know, Ilhan, people like AOC and Ayanna Pressley. The good thing about this election, you are starting to see people move into Congress who come from those communities. Cory Bush is another example.
Yep. Jamal
and there
Bowman.
Are people. Yeah, yeah. And there's people on the outside who are starting to push that back and forth, like a little bit like Julian Castro. I think what's going to happen is, since the people who are corporatists only listen to people who they feel like are on their level, those are the people, if they would get out of their way and let them speak to them and let them speak to the concerns of their constituents, I think that's one way you can maybe start moving some of this out of this idea that people who only got $1,200 and that's enough for them to last them through a cold winter. The other,
it's really on the surface, it's just insane, right? Like, it's insanity. And this is why they have to gaslight us so much and sedate us with the platitudes, because the reality is no one can survive this pandemic with just $1,200.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's like I said, it's not even winter yet. The other way to make that happen is, I think, even though it may be a cliche, but I think people are going to have to get back on the streets again. Mm-hmm. I know it's going to be tough, and I know it's going to be tricky, and it's going to be difficult, especially now, because everything's supposed to be cleared up now. We're free of the monster, so people shouldn't have any reason to demonstrate anymore. But look, if you are surviving, if you're barely surviving and you don't know where your next meal is coming from, you have to make yourself known, however you have to do that. If it's by reaching out to people, the people I mentioned, to let them know what your concerns are, if it's by making enough noise that the people have no choice to see you, then that's what has to be done. But this is, I don't have any definite answers on that, but I know that this situation just can't continue, and something has to be done about that. But I mean, the cold hard fact is the people who run Wall Street, CEOs, corporate donors, these are the people who they listen to first. And until you get their attention away from that and let them know this really existential crisis that America is in, and the great vast majority of the people who voted them in are in, I don't see how that's going to change.
Yeah. And again, like you kind of alluded to earlier, there's such a disconnect between these corporate Democrats and Republicans in Washington, because they're in this little, bubble there in Washington. They're so disconnected from the pain of their constituents and the pain of everyday working class Americans. And I do they not understand where this is all going? Like, do they not have the foresight, or do they just not care? I mean, today, actually, sadly, the Dow Jones just hit a record high. It just hit 30,000, mm-hmm. But we got 50 million people who are going hungry, So like, we're living in this time of just great wealth disparity that rivals the Gilded Age, a period that saw, what happened after the Gilded Age? We had a Great Depression, mm-hmm. And then FDR had to pass the New Deal to renegotiate the contract between, capital and labor. And we are at another one of those moments in history where, like, we need a new economic bill of rights that is going to lift up the poor, the working class, and communities of color. And do you see Joe Biden passing an economic bill of rights to help the most vulnerable? I don't. Like, I don't see him doing any of that, which means that things are just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse.
Here's an analogy I like to use. Every year they do the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and you see all these people who pretend to be mortal enemies online and on TV, all hugged up and laughing and joking all together.
Right.
It's like George Carlin said, it's a big club and we ain't in it.
That's right. Yeah. Trouble is coming. I mean, if they don't get there, if they don't figure it out, like, things are going to get so bad. And you know what happens when people's material conditions get so bad? They have no choice but to revolt. So that's mm-hmm. like, I think some of these corrupt politicians don't really know what's coming down the road. I want to ask you about a little bit about Context Media and your group, as we kind of close the show here. What is your mission, and how can my listeners help your efforts?
I started Context Media because my background is in journalism, and I had a number of years in mainstream journalism. My coinciding with mainstream journalism started around the time that Ferguson exploded. And I filed a lot of stories about the protest movement that formed around that, between that and Baltimore and other places. And basically, I just saw a disconnect between some of the stories I was filing for other news orgs and what I saw on the ground. So I decided, I have experience. I have some connections. Why not start talking to people who are on the ground, who are activists, who are people, poor and working class people, and give them a voice? So I started Context Media basically to give these people a voice and let writers who are from those communities have a voice. I did that, and also started I did a documentary called 5 Years, Mike Brown and Ferguson Now, about the aftermath of Ferguson 5 years later when everybody came into that. So that was my background for starting Context Media, basically just to give people a voice who didn't have one.
No, it's beautiful. That's what's needed, right? So we can hear the stories of the people on the ground, not hear two pundits who are on CNN, freaking out because Trump tweeted something, or freaking out because Pelosi ripped up a speech. We need to hear the real stories of the real people who are actually, struggling. I think that is why actually America is where it is, with this great, wealth disparity, because it's almost like the, you know, people who are comfortable, these comfortable liberals who we told the unapologetic truth about today, but they're not really getting, you know, without context media and without, you know, outfits like yours, they're not hearing any of the stories of the people who are struggling. And which makes me realize, like, it's almost like the poor and the working class are suffering in silence because they have no mm-hmm. voice anywhere. We know they don't have a voice in Congress because we know who our Congress works for. They all work for Wall Street. You turn on MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, you're not hearing, you know, any stories about the poor and the working class. And in fact, when these quote unquote liberal media, don't you love how they call it liberal media? When during the mm-hmm. primary, MSNBC spent the entire primary fear mongering about Medicare for all, about the one mm-hmm. policy that would really lift up, you know, so many of the communities that need help the most. And so, no, you see that I see an anti-progressive bias in the media. I see an anti-working class bias in the media, and I see an anti, you know, people of color bias in the media. And the one time you get people in there, it's almost like they're scared to share the unapologetic truth on those platforms because it's just, you know, you see some people who I know some people who have been on MSNBC and I'm like, wait a second, like, that's not like how they tweet. Like they're already watering down yeah. what they believe in because all of a sudden they're, you know, they're in the machine. So they have to kind of start talking how the machine talks. And it's, so we need outfits like Context Media. How can people follow Context Media?
You can follow Context Media on the website, contextmediagroup.com. You can also follow us on all the socials. It's Context Media Group on Twitter, Context Media on IG, and also on Facebook. And I also have a YouTube channel, Context Media, where I do live interviews with people.
Amazing. And because it's so bleak out there right now, I want to end the show on a kind of a more hopeful note. Because even though it is so bleak, I think it's still important to find gratitude, you know, where we can. And it is Thanksgiving in a few days. Torin, where do you find gratitude right now? Like, what are you grateful for this year amidst all of this kind of pain and suffering that our nation's going through?
I'm grateful for health. I know there's a lot of people out there who are dealing with this pandemic, who have lost people and lost family and loved ones. And I'm grateful for the fact that my body is intact and I'm healthy and I'm able to talk to people who are willing to share themselves with me. And I appreciate that.
That's beautiful. And how can people follow you on Twitter?
You can follow me. My handle is Torin Walker, T-O-R-R-A-I-N-E, Walker. I'm on there way more than I probably need to be, but that's where you can usually find me.
Awesome. Well, hey, I really appreciate you taking some time to talk to us today and wishing you a happy Thanksgiving and let's keep in touch.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Torin and make sure to check out Context Media on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. And before I go, I want to take a moment and thank our VIP Patreon subscribers who make this podcast possible. If you want to be a Patreon subscriber, you can go to patreon.com/proudsocialist and chip in $5 a month or whatever you can to make this podcast possible. And just a reminder, we are going to start providing video as well for everyone who's a Patreon subscriber. We're going to start that in a few weeks. So look out for that. And so for this week, I want to thank Tiffany Mahmood. I want to thank Eric Peterson. I want to thank Jean-Paul DeLuca. I want to thank Jean-Michael DiPardo. I want to thank Susan Sarandon. I want to thank DJ Comatose. I want to thank Shauna Pearson, Patty Cleary, and Elizabeth Kim. And also I want to thank all of our listeners who listen to the show every week and tell your friends and family about the show. This podcast would not be possible without all of you. So thank you for supporting Amped Up and listening to Amped Up and sharing it with people. And I hope everyone has a safe holidays. And we will catch you next week with an all-new episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight.